I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, December 18th. The Trump administration may be ending, but national politics is not. With COVID relief of various kinds expiring for millions of Americans in just a few days, Congress still hasn't agreed on a new package, though leaders say they are very close. The lead New York Times headline on this morning says Biden faces challenge as Congress drops state aid to secure stimulus. Other challenges for the president-elect include a big new Russian hack that got revealed this week. They may have failed at hacking our democracy this time around, but they're still hacking our government. Revelations keep coming about Hunter Biden that are leading President Trump to consider a special counsel, like Robert Mueller was, as a parting gift to the president-elect, you might call it. And if Joe Biden really hopes to depolarize the country, which he says is one of his main goals, how can his administration do that while still criticizing Republicans when they disagree? Biden's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, made conservative media headlines this week when, in the context of defending compromise to a progressive group, she said this: in the primary, people would mock Biden, like, "You think you can work with Republicans?" And she went on to say, "I'm not saying they're not a bunch of effers. Mitch McConnell is terrible." And of course, I cleaned up effers for the radio. Well, that may be a defense of compromise, but is it a path to unity? With us now, Associated Press, White House correspondent, and NBC News political analyst, Jonathan Lemire. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, good morning. Always great to be here.
And here's the president-elect speaking earlier this month about the need for state and local government relief in the stimulus bill.
States and cities are already facing large, large budget shortfalls this year, again, through no fault of their own. They've already laid off more than a million workers, even more teachers, firefighters, cops will lose their jobs unless federal government steps up now.
And saying the same thing yesterday in even more pointed terms, New York City Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she said, quote, "You want to know who's actually trying to defund the police? Republicans, because Republicans are trying to block state and local funding so that those budgets dry up." So, Jonathan Lemire, red states are facing COVID budget shocks, too. Why is state and local aid being cut out of the emerging bill?
The politics of this from the beginning, Brian, have been Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, of course, a Republican, and many in on his side of the aisle have suggested that the local and state aid would be a blue state bailout in their estimation, and that they felt that it would be unfairly headed towards blue cities, Democratic-controlled states, the big cities that we saw, particularly in the early months of the pandemic, really suffer, which, of course, includes New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, others, and that the politics of that have still not totally changed. McConnell has had a hard time selling that to his conference. That even though the stats are clear, there's been 1.3 million state and local jobs lost since March, and there is great concern, particularly on Biden's incoming team, that those losses could grow. That any economic recovery that we may see in the early part of 2021, after Biden takes office, as the vaccine begins to disseminate, as life slowly sort of reemerges to its pre-pandemic form, that recovery would be hampered by the fact there could be severe cuts in these municipal governments, state governments, big city governments, resulting in waves of layoffs.
You have a story today about President Trump clashing with Republicans in Congress, too, about how much of a direct payment stimulus check Americans will get. Where are they disagreeing?
Well, the president, as he is often wont to do, tends to sort of wade in at the 11th hour and threaten to blow things up. Yes, I believe it was in the Washington Post first reported today, matched by others, that the president wanted a $2,000 payment, direct payment, the stimulus payment to Americans, as opposed to the 600 or so, which is where the current negotiations were, and had to be talked out of it by aides, saying that if this last minute monkey wrench was thrown into the talks, it could blow them up right ahead of the deadline. So the president has backed off that. We've seen him tweet a little bit saying that a deal should get done. There is still a lot of second guessing around the president, who felt that he should have been far more out there during the summer and early fall, pushing for a big COVID deal, pushing for more direct relief, pushing for the stimulus, thinking that would have helped him during his campaign. But that was something that the Republicans in the Senate simply did not want to go along. So it never happened. And we are, again, Congress, as the cliche goes, only works when it's up against a deadline. It is up against one now in order to get some sort of deal done before these benefits run out. And even if that requires setting aside the local and state aid into a different package, much over the protests of President-elect Biden.
So we've talked about some of the issues that divide the Democrats and Republicans, and even the Republicans and the White House. But I don't want to gloss over the fact that there are still many things that are in the bill expected to pass sometime, maybe today or sometime before Monday. Can you give us the highlights?
There certainly will be. There will be, first of all, as we just discussed, there will be indeed the direct payments to people, to average Americans. So it'll be $600 direct payments for American families and children. That now, to be clear, that's only about half of what the stimulus checks were done last spring, but it still will help. There's also an extension of unemployment programs, which was something that both sides of the aisle did come around. They were going to sunset, and now they will be able to move forward. There will be Republicans, have fought against this local and state aid, but there should be other measures that will help prop up the economy here. And we've seen it. We've seen the numbers even this past week with the unemployment claims continuing to increase. And I think there is a sense, and this is something that both the president-elect team is deeply mindful of, that though there is suddenly hope on the horizon in the form of this vaccine, as we hear time and again, it'll be months and months before most Americans are able to obtain it. And until then, we're going to have a very difficult time. And that, of course, first and foremost means in terms of the health crisis, we are seeing the staggering numbers of deaths each and every day. But that also refers to the economy. And that's what they're focused on here. And that's why they've been prodding to grow this bill, while House Speaker Pelosi has been pushing for some time to finally get them to the table, while Republicans have come to an agreement, one that has, several times over recent weeks looked like it was going to fall apart for good. And even now, as is Congress's way, we had a day or so ago, a deal was imminent, but yet we're still not quite there.
Listeners, our phones are open and topics on the table for AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, the COVID relief bill talks, Jan O'Malley Dillon's comments about Republicans being effers, does Biden need to respond to establish his path to unity, the Russian hacking revelations, and should there be a special counsel to continue the federal investigation into Hunter Biden's taxes once his father takes office, or anything else you always wanted to ask Jonathan Lemire after seeing him on television, but you never had him over for dinner. 646-435-7280, or you can tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. So, Jonathan, if Joe Biden really hopes to depolarize the country, which, of course, he says is one of his main goals, how can his administration do that while still criticizing Republicans when they disagree, because he still will need to do that? And because he wants to be able to do both, fight for policies he believes in while changing the divide and conquer tone that Trump very consciously set, that's been so destructive. There's this story that Biden's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, this week, when in the context of defending compromise, said this: in the primary, people would mock Biden like, you think you can work with Republicans. I'm not saying they're not a bunch of effers. Mitch McConnell is terrible. So that may be one way to defend compromise, Jonathan, to a liberal group, I gather she was addressing. But is it a path to unity?
Well, first I'll note that once the pandemic lifts, I'm a delightful dinner guest, and I'm always into a home-cooked meal. So that's consider that me accepting the invitation. Yes, what we have here with the Republicans, as someone put it over the weekend or the last couple of days, the Republicans growing outrage or faux outrage about coarse language is a sign that perhaps nature is healing. Because let's remember, we have a president who has coarsened the language repeatedly over his 4 years in office, saying things from the stump behind the Oval Office desk or on Twitter that would be unimaginable for one of his predecessors to say in public presence. They curse in private all the time. It is rare to have the language that Donald Trump has used while in office. So there's certainly a degree of hypocrisy. But to your larger point, yes, this does show the bind that the Biden team is in. And I think we should set aside this comment here, and perhaps even whether it's the assessment is accurate or not. But Biden ran, unlike basically any of his Democratic rivals during the primaries, as someone who would want to sort of unite the country, talk again about reaching across the aisle, talk about all the bipartisan relationships he had. He's a creature of the Senate. He spent decades there. He talks a lot about the legislation he worked with to pass with his Republican colleagues, the strong friendships he had, and occasionally got in trouble for it, where because the country is so polarized right now, it is so partisan. The fuels of the fires of this bitter rivalry between Republicans and Democrats, of course, stoked by President Trump more than anyone else. And there are a lot of Democrats who feel like they don't want to be compromising right now. They feel like, what has compromise gotten us in the past? When have Republicans ever compromised with us? And we're seeing now, and a subject we can return to, members of the Republican Party not even recognizing President-elect Biden's victory. So there's a sense of, like, why should we have to always be the adult in the room, Democrats say. That said, there has to be at least some effort to work together. And there's some thought in Washington that McConnell and Biden, who have a relationship, might be willing to get some deals together, that maybe Biden is a Democrat who's uniquely situated to get something done. There's some thought of an infrastructure package, maybe being the first big piece that the Biden administration rolls out early next year. But it is going to be, of course, extremely challenging for the president-elect to do so. And why, again, a lot rides on the outcome of those runoff races in Georgia early next month, where if somehow the Democrats were able to move into the majority in the Senate and control both control all three, White House, House, and Senate, that would make Biden's path a lot easier.
Do you have any reason to believe, with your experience as a correspondent in Washington, that Biden's friendship or long relationship with Mitch McConnell would affect anything? You know, what's the cliche? If you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. And if McConnell's commitment is to increasing Republican power at every turn, and his path to that during the Obama administration was to obstruct everything Obama proposed, even if they might have had some basis for an agreement on parts of it, why would McConnell act any differently with Joe Biden?
The skepticism is well founded here, Brian. I mean, yes, Senate Majority Leader McConnell is perhaps the most political character in Washington we've seen in a while, and he is indeed solely focused on maintaining his power, meaning the Senate majority, which he has used, of course, helped reshape the federal judiciary. We know, of course, what happened with the Supreme Court picks, refusing to bring Merrick Garland to hearings or a vote back in 2016, but then rushing through Amy Coney Barrett this time around, right before Election Day. He's cravenly political, frankly, a label that he would embrace. So I think that any cooperation that McConnell offers would be done out of a calculation that it would be in self-interest for him and the Republicans, that if he feels that voters demand something to be done and that therefore he needs to work with the Biden White House, he will. But otherwise, he won't, if he feels that if it's something that could jeopardize his hold on the Senate.
And just one other thing on Jen O'Malley Dillon. She was campaign manager in the campaign, obviously. Does she have a role in the Biden administration?
She does. She will be coming in as a deputy White House chief of staff, right under Ron Klain, who is Biden's longtime aide, who is the chief of staff. So, yes, Jen O'Malley Dillon will be playing an important role in the Biden administration. And certainly, look, people I've talked to in Biden world wish she had said that differently. But it's also they're pointing to the idea this is simply a distraction. This is the question of Republicans about to lose power who spent 4 years claiming they didn't see the tweets that Donald Trump issued that threatened at times to undo the very democratic process. But now suddenly being grievously offended by this tweet.
Well, the Republican hypocrisy there is not debatable. But if Biden wants to change something, he could consider firing her or rebuking her publicly like he means it and saying, you know, Mitch McConnell is looking out for his constituents like Democrats look out for ours. I'm going to respect that and work to make deals in everyone's interest, not call our colleagues effers. Might we hear something like that?
We haven't yet. I don't know that we will. I think that there is a sense in Biden world that they want this to just, they feel this will be a story that will blow over in a couple of days. We'll be on to something else. I mean, yes, certainly Joe Biden is one. Far more than, frankly, other Democrats and even members of his own staff believe that there is an opportunity here to work across the aisle. Perhaps he would say something, but I haven't heard that he will at this point, and there's been no indication that he will offer any sort of apology, and certainly not fire someone who is a key member of his inner circle.
John in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi. This morning, I mean, the budget stuff is fascinating, could get into that, but this morning there's a spat between the White House and Pfizer. Pfizer says we have hundreds of thousands of doses of vaccine in storage, and we're waiting for the White House to tell us where to send it. The White House, I think, I'd be curious to know, says, no, it's your fault, you're screwing up. So this seems to me just total, typical Trumpian incompetence, and I'd love to have some light shed on it, because it seems crazed.
Jonathan,
and I think DeSantis in Florida has gotten into this, too, blaming Pfizer instead of, you know, the usual,
Jonathan,
not our fault.
Are you reporting on this? Are you familiar with it?
We certainly have been, and what we're seeing here is some of this is what has been the Trump administration's pattern since the first days of this pandemic, where they defer a lot of it to the states. The states saying we need this number of back then ventilators, now vaccine doses. And yes, there has certainly been some friction between, there's a backstory here, friction between the White House and Pfizer, where Pfizer, was not a full-fledged participant in Operation Warp Speed, you know, that they're using federal resources to help for the distribution, but not for the development. And there was some bristling where the White House tried to really claim credit for that, for all parts of the vaccine. Pfizer saying, no, that's not the case. We know that the Pfizer CEO has more than once publicly said that the company would not give in to political pressure. It would not rush vaccine development over the spring, summer, and fall, even though the White House was hammering them to try to get it out before Election Day, thinking that would boost Trump's reelection chances. We know that the head of Pfizer also skipped the Operation Warp Speed Summit that was held at the White House a week or so ago, again, not wanting to be politicized. And yes, right now we are seeing this play back out in public, back and forth, about whether or not there are enough vaccines that are available to be distributed now. White House saying one thing, Pfizer another. But let's also remember, the White House had the option to purchase more of the drugs from Pfizer over the summer. They bought 100 million doses. Pfizer said, well, we can do up to 500 million more, or at least another 100 or 200 million more now. The White House declined to do that initially, and therefore now has come around with the vaccine out there, approved and seemingly effective, and wanted to buy more. And Pfizer have been unable to do that right off the bat because it had already made commitments to other countries, that it was also selling, of course, the vaccine of other places around the world. And there is, as much as they are working to develop in as much doses as they can, there's only so fast you can go. So therefore, the White House has been frustrated that they're not able to get their hands on more of these doses as quickly as they'd like.
Judy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Jonathan. I have a question about the unemployment extension. I've been following the negotiations pretty closely, and I still can't figure out what they're talking about. So the question is, the unemployment extension, is that adding additional weeks on top of the standard 26, or is it just paying up more money every week until your 26 weeks runs out?
Unemployment benefits are certainly being extended. That this is one of the measures that seems to have broad support on both sides of the aisle. I believe some of the details are still being worked out in terms of exactly how in terms of in the, whether it's the dilemma you just explained. But this is something that, you know, again, we're not going to know entirely until it's done, which it's not done yet. And there's certainly real hope that it will be today or tomorrow. But there does seem to be some consensus here that unemployment benefits will be done. But really, again, there are a few sticking points remaining, but that does not appear to be one of them.
Judy, thank you. You know, when Mayor Bill de Blasio comes on the show later, I'm going to ask him the implications for New York City of the emerging relief bill, apparently not including state and local aid. I'm getting a question from a listener that says, why would Pelosi agree to this bill without state and federal aid? She stood steadfastly for this against a so-called skinny bill for the last several months under the premise that if you agree to the things that everybody agrees on, meaning the things we've been talking about, unemployment extension and a stimulus check of some kind and a few other things, then you've lost your power to negotiate for the things that the other side doesn't want, like state and federal aid. So is Pelosi giving up her power here, or is this a necessary loss because she couldn't make the Senate do something they wouldn't do, and they had to take care of people's basic needs here before these bills expire at the end of the year?
I think that's largely the correct framing, that they are seeing the crisis that the country is in right now, one that would only grow so much worse if indeed these benefits all expire. And they felt like there was an act. They weren't going to let perfectly the enemy of the good here. And there's also a belief that they wanted to get some deal now, because there will indeed be there'll be a different calculation and calculus next year once the new administration is in the White House and once we know the outcome of the Georgia Senate races. So there's a sense here from both sides that some sort of deal had to get done now, and then one can be revisited. And now it could be revisited in very wildly different shapes next year, depending on who controls the Senate. But that the sense is the House Speaker that there needed to be some sort of extension now, or that we'd see the economy crater that much further just as Joe Biden comes to office.
Associated Press White House correspondent and NBC News political analyst Jonathan Lemire. Thanks as always, Jonathan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's do it again soon. Happy holidays.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.